I'm Holly Kernan, and this is Your Call. Are environmentalists being specifically targeted as a domestic threat in the United States? Our next guest, Will Potter, is the author of Green is the New Red, an insider's account of a social movement under siege. He documents the creation of the term eco-terrorism in the 1980s and charts how it became a top FBI priority. He says the government uses scare tactics, often in concert with corporations, even against some nonviolent activists. On May 24, 1990, Earth First activists Judy Berry and Daryl Cherney were driving in Oakland when a bomb exploded in their car. Berry suffered extensive injuries. The FBI accused the two of creating and transporting that bomb, despite clear evidence that the explosive was underneath Berry's seat. The case was eventually dropped for lack of evidence. After a long legal battle, Cherney successfully sued the FBI in 2002 and eventually won a $4 million settlement. But the case has never been solved. Last month, an Oakland judge ordered the FBI to hand over evidence so that it can finally be tested. So today we'll talk with Daryl Cherney and Will Potter about environmental activism and surveillance. Are radical environmentalists a domestic threat? Are law enforcement officials specifically targeting certain activists? And how does that affect the broader environmental movement? Joining us today is Daryl Cherney, producer of the film Who Bombed Judy Berry. Welcome, Daryl. Daryl, do we have you with us?
Here.
Hi, Daryl, and congratulations. I understand that you are a new father.
I am. Thank you so much.
Absolutely. We're also joined in studio by Dennis Cunningham. He is was the attorney for Judy Berry and Daryl Cherney. Welcome, Dennis. And Will Potter is the author of Green is the New Red, an insider's account of a social movement under siege. Welcome, Will.
Thank you for having me.
And I'll give out our number to take your calls in just a moment. But let's start with you, Will, and the premise in your book that environmental and animal rights activists are being targeted as eco-terrorists. So can you just give us a sketch of who's being targeted and what's happening to them?
Sure. Well, as you laid out in your introduction, I mean, it really began in the early 1980s and dovetailed with the rapid growth of the animal rights and environmental movements. And corporations created this term eco-terrorism that they used relentlessly over the next 20 years until it became what the FBI has repeatedly called the number one domestic terrorism threat. And that kind of rhetoric is used so broadly to incorporate groups like Earth First, all the way to the Animal Liberation Front and Earth Liberation Front, in addition to people who do things like undercover investigations and nonviolent civil disobedience and tree sits. I mean, there's been an incredibly wide range of activity, none of it violent, none of it approaching anyone's idea of terrorism, that are being targeted by the government and corporations right now.
And you say that the term eco-terrorism was actually created by corporations and then appropriated by the FBI.
That's right. And in working on the book, this was a really difficult area to map out, because at some point, the rhetoric of corporations and industry groups really took on a life of its own. I mean, it was really interesting to me to see in the earlier stages of this that there was coverage in the New York Times, the Washington Post, USA Today, not calling environmentalists eco-terrorists, but looking at their civil disobedience and tree sits and road blockades as heroic, and at the very worst as eco-vandals or eco-saboteurs. At some point, though, like I said, it really took on a life of its own, and it turned into this national government priority, and now we have specific legislation carving out special protections for these industries and labeling environmentalists as terrorists, and we also have special units of the FBI and Homeland Security investigating them as well.
And I'll ask you more about that later. But what do you think are there real threats from radical activists? What do you think they are? And can you tell us about a few of the underground groups carrying out sabotage around the U.S.?
Absolutely. I think it's important to remember that the reason these activists are being targeted is because they are a threat. Not in the way that corporations are necessarily depicting them, though. I mean, they've been an incredible threat to corporate profits. These activists are being targeted because they're effective. And I say they're being effective in a wide range of activity, from underground groups like the Animal Liberation Front and Earth Liberation Front, who have destroyed corporate property, sabotaged SUVs, released animals from fur farms, things like that, Then you have other groups like Earth First or Sea Shepherd, who have used nonviolent civil disobedience and publicity stunts and things like this. And then you even have more national and above ground groups doing undercover investigations, media spectacles, all of it's being labeled as eco-terrorism. And I think the only way to explain that is that all of those tactics have had their specific and different roles in threatening corporate interest, and that's why the backlash has been so severe.
But there were some real threats, like the Unabomber, Ted Kaczynski.
Right, and the Unabomber is an interesting case because he never considered himself part of any environmental movement, although, you know, in hindsight, some people have kind of embraced some parts of his manifesto and his beliefs about the dangers of industrial civilization. But I think it's important to point out that even according to the FBI, according to congressional testimony, when we're talking about groups like the Earth Liberation Front, the broader environmental movement, no one has ever been injured. I mean, the Unabomber was a very specific and unique example, and a very rare one, too.
So you really say that what's happening is economic sabotage, economic damage, rather than violence against people.
Absolutely. And that's not just according to my, you know, analysis of the history of these movements. That's according to the rhetoric of the FBI and Homeland Security, congressional testimony, internal corporate documents. All of this is framing the issue in terms of the threat that these activists pose to corporate profits. I mean, with new laws like the Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act and laws like the Model ALEC Bill, the Animal and Ecological Terrorism Act, they're specifically carving out penalties based on damages to corporate profits. I mean, that's been the cornerstone of all of this.
And let's move to Daryl and talk a little bit about the history of Earth First. Will Potter calls the 1990s hardcore, and you and Judy Berry were both part of Earth First as environmental activists. You were involved as organizers at the time of your car bombing, and that's kind of the central event of your film, Who Bombed Judy Berry. How did you get involved with Earth First, and what was its mission and strategy as you saw it, Daryl?
Well, I think what attracted me the most about Earth First was its lack of structure, that it didn't have a board of directors. It also had a, in other words, anybody could rise to become a media spokesperson, an organizer, and what kept you in check was not a series of bylaws, but rather a tradition. Earth First considers itself a tribe, a warrior tribe, in fact. And so we regulate ourselves through those kinds of, you know, more peer group pressure rather than any kind of written manifesto. I was interested in Earth First because when I moved to Humboldt County, California, in late 1985, Maxam Corporation had taken over Pacific Lumber. And here is, you know, a classic example of what I would call economic terrorism against the Redwoods and against a company that was practicing sustainable forestry. Pacific Lumber was on the New York Stock Exchange, but they were not Maxamizing their profits. They were, you know, giving large scholarships to the kids of the mill workers and loggers there. They would never clear cut. They, after 118 years of logging, they still had 78,000 acres of ancient forest and no clear cutting at all ever. And so Wall Street looks at that kind of benevolent, sustainable, and what I would call true conservative, timber practices as something to attack, something to destroy, that that the only proper way of doing business is to rape and pillage the environment, to rape and pillage corporations that don't just loot everything they possibly can. And so because of that, and I was here in Humboldt, I decided Earth First was the proper vehicle to take on the Maxam Corporation, started working with a man named Greg King, a media journalist, a photographer who became an activist, and we organized protests, and then eventually with Judy Berry, who expanded our efforts to start organizing loggers and millworkers into the movement to stop these corporations. And so that's kind of what drew me into Earth First, and it was, and also the philosophy of biocentrism, that the Earth has a right to be here regardless of its benefits to human beings, was very appealing to me. You know, I was not educated in biology or ecology, and yet I felt a concern for the biology and ecology of the planet. Why do I have to have a scientific degree in order to defend Mother Earth? And so what attracted me to Earth First was that you could say, hey, we all have a right to be here. The Earth is ours to share, not to hoard. And to me, that was what was perhaps the most appealing.
And Daryl, let's go back to 1990 and kind of the atmosphere at that time. I know there was an effort to unite environmentalists and loggers around the idea of sustainable harvesting, but the divide between environmentalists and loggers became really toxic with activists being accused of tactics like tree spiking, and then with you and Judy getting these death threats. Now, Will Potter looks at the accusations of tree spiking and says that he couldn't find any documentation of that actually happening. So we'll bring you into this in just a sec, Will. But why did the atmosphere up in Northern California become so toxic at that point?
We have to consider that when the Back to the Land movement, also known as the hippies, moved to Northern California in 1969 to 72, 73, there was an ongoing battle between the rednecks and the hippies up here in Humboldt-Mendocino counties long before Earth First ever showed up. So there was already tensions going on. We had a redneck hospital, a hippie hospital. You know, we had a redneck supermarket, a hippie supermarket. You know, in other words, there was a sort of a segregation that had a 25-year history before Earth First even, you know, showed up. So that sort of set a framework. But absolutely, Earth First did, the journal itself did provide a forum for sabotage and defense of the environment. But to a large extent, that forum was simply designed to attract media attention, to get the conversation going. And occasional acts of sabotage did take place. A road might be dug up, a culvert plugged. But the overwhelming majority of actions were public actions with people sitting in trees, blockading bulldozers, that kind of thing.
And Daryl, was tree spiking happening?
There was in Humboldt County, where we were acting, and in Mendocino County, no, there was no tree spiking happening. There was tree spiking happening in Oregon, Washington, Idaho. And in fact, our group took a stand against tree spiking. Tree spiking meaning the placing of nails in trees that would stop a blade from going through the nail. That was just
and could potentially hurt the logger.
That was never the intention of tree spiking, by the way. However, that did prove to be the case in 1987 when a mill worker was injured when a blade went through it, through a tree spike, and it basically exploded, almost killing him. And that is in our movie. We completely show the downside of tree spiking in the movie Who Bombed Judy Barry. So absolutely, tree spiking was on the table, and it was Judy Barry and myself and others who said, no, you can't be doing that, because it can injure, because the mill workers and loggers, because guess what? Mill workers, loggers, and environmentalists have much more in common with each other than we do with the titans of industry, and that we need to unite. That is sort of an early version of the 99%.
And, Will, I don't know if you wanted to get in on the tree spiking question, because I know that you dedicate at least a page to it.
Just to clarify, I mean, I was... not even when you say that wasn't happening, the context in which it came up in the book was looking at some of the congressional hearings that were being used to call for new eco-terrorism legislation in the late 90s, or starting in the mid-90s to late 90s. And the question arose of members of Congress talking about tree spiking and saying, you know, these environmentalists are out there spiking trees, trying to kill people, and they've killed all these people. And so I looked at some of those claims and found out it wasn't actually true. I mean, they were manipulating what was going on, much like Daryl was saying, that there were actions of tree spiking taking place, but it certainly was never the intention to harm anyone. And the actions by environmentalists, as far as I could see in all my research for the book, weren't responsible for harming any human beings. The most infamous example that I think might have been alluded to earlier, where a mill worker was injured, it actually came out that the individual who spiked those trees was a disgruntled landowner in the area. So I say all this just to point out that, you know, the acts of sabotage that do take place in the name of the environment are also manipulated and exploited to try to elevate this idea of the threat from environmentalists, who in actuality are bent on protecting human life and protecting the environment.
And so let's go back Daryl, to May 24th, 1990. You and Judy were driving through Oakland on your way to a rally in Santa Cruz where you were organizing for Redwood Summer, and a bomb went off in the car. You were both injured, Judy very badly injured. Can you briefly tell us what happened on May 24th, 1990?
Well, Judy and I were traveling on our way to do a concert. Judy played the fiddle, I played the guitar, we sang songs, and we organized through music as well as speech making, and we had a slideshow. Also, by the way, in that car at the time was a file folder full of death threats that we were receiving due to our organizing efforts for Redwood Summer 1990. And Redwood Summer was designed and did, in fact, bring thousands of people to the Humboldt-Mendocino County areas to protest to slow down the logging. It was also during an election year where Forest Forever Proposition 130 was on the statewide ballot here in California. It ultimately lost by one percentage point, with the industry using that car bombing to try to discredit Forest Forever, and apparently successfully. But at the time, we were on our way to do a show. We were on our way to do a gig. And but one of the reasons we were on the road was we'd received so many death threats, we wanted to get out of town, out of Dodge, and maybe still organize kids by doing a college tour, a free college tour. So when we were leaving Oakland on at just before 12 noon, we kind of thought we were safe. And as I got into the car with Judy, we drove for maybe a minute at the most, and all of a sudden, reality was changed forever. A bomb exploded. I didn't know it was a bomb at the time, but I learned quickly thereafter that it was. Judy knew immediately, ripping her apart. I was the bomb force was deflected, so I was only slightly injured. But we were pretty much accused of being the bombers within minutes of the bomb going off. And you'll see how the police, right on the scene, lied immediately about the location of the bomb. Judy, by the way, was in an intensive care unit, and they handcuffed her to her hospital bed. But in the meantime, the police were immediately manipulating evidence. They found a ball bearing, which indicated that the bomb was a motion device, which turned out to be the case, that the bomb would only go off in a moving car. And the police even labeled it a booby trap, which meant that we had to interact with the device in order for it to explode. It was a booby trap, victim operated. And yet they crossed that out with a pen. They crossed it out so that it wouldn't look like we were the victims. And they said the nails strapped to the bomb matched nails in the back of Judy's car. Judy was a professional carpenter, led a construction crew. She had roofing nails in the back of her car, and there was finishing nails strapped to the bomb. They don't look anything like each other. And they said the bomb was in plain view in the back seat, when the back seat was barely damaged, not even damaged at all, and whereas the front seat where the bomb actually was obliterated, with Judy's underside being obliterated as well. So they were immediately lying about the evidence from minute one, you know, giving pause, you know, to ask the question, you know, what did they know at the time the bomb went off that they decided to lie about the evidence so quickly?
And that's Daryl Cherney, producer of the film Who Bombed Judy Berry. You're listening to Your Call. I'm Holly Kernan. We're going to hear from Judy Berry from your film. She died of cancer before you were even able to win your FBI case. But let me invite our listeners into this conversation. We're also speaking with Dennis Cunningham, who was an attorney for Judy Berry and Daryl Cherney, and Will Potter, the author of Green is the New Red, an insider's account of a social movement under siege. And I'm going to give out the number. It's 866-798-8255. If you were or are now part of Earth First or any other counterculture direct action group or movement, from civil rights to Occupy, what has your experience been with the crackdown from law enforcement? Is sabotage terrorism? And how radical is reasonable in the struggle for ecological justice? You can call us and join our conversation at 866-798-TALK. That's a toll-free number, 866-798-8255. You can also send us an email to feedback@yourcallradio.org. Activist Tim DeChristopher is currently serving a 2-year prison sentence for entering his name in a Bureau of Land Management auction back in 2008. Is that a reasonable punishment for that crime? Is civil disobedience an American tradition, and when does it go too far? Give us a call at 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255, or you can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org. And We're going to play a clip from the film Who Bombed Judy Berry. This is Judy Berry talking about what happened after the bombing.
I remember waking up and finding myself completely immobile and my leg up in a traction device. And I remember that there were two uniformed police standing next to me as soon as I opened my eyes.
Did the two uniformed officers speak to you?
Yes. They told me that I was under arrest, and they said they wanted to, for transporting explosives, I guess.
And what was your response to that then?
I said I wouldn't talk to them without a lawyer.
Is the police case falling apart?
I wish I could see the police case. My feeling is because they didn't file charges today, it certainly is not a strong case.
The Oakland Police Department still considers them as suspects in this case, and we have no indication at this point to indicate otherwise. We have no information to indicate anybody else is involved, and we're still looking at it, them as suspects in the case.
I think that they're looking at entirely the wrong places. And I don't think that they're doing a thorough investigation. I think that the police tactics need to be investigated here.
The real fundamental questions are remaining unasked. You know, whose interest is this in to have these two people bombed?
And that is a clip from the film Who Bombed Judy Berry, which was produced by Daryl Cherney, one of our guests. And you can see that film tomorrow, May 10th, at the Real Work May Day Labor Film Festival at San Jose City College Tech Auditorium. We'll put all of this information on our website. That's yourcallradio.org. It's also playing Friday, May 11th at 6:45 at the Santa Cruz Film Festival at the Nickelodeon Theater. Again, we'll put all of the information on where to see the film at yourcallradio.org.
And that's a week from tomorrow, by the way.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm ahead of myself. You're right. That's all next week. Excuse me, Daryl.
Yes, and our website, whobombedjudybarry.com, that's J-U-D-I-B-A-R-I, also has that schedule. So either website.
And let's bring Dennis Cunningham into the conversation now, because he was the lawyer in all of this. It was a very complicated legal case. But you've been a civil rights lawyer since the 60s. Where does this fit into kind of COINTELPRO and FBI monitoring of activist groups in the U.S.?
Well, it's right in the mainstream of that, call it a tradition. The COINTELPRO mechanism that was adopted really in the 40s and 50s and by the FBI, which was a program of activities designed to what they called neutralize political groups of individuals who were, working against the establishment, working against the status quo, working for different forms of social change. And this was certainly that, although it was new in the sense that it was involved the private sector.
And that's Dennis Cunningham. He's an attorney with Judy Berry and Daryl Cherney. We're going to continue to talk about that after a short break. We're talking about how law enforcement targets environmental activists and what constitutes eco-terrorism. How much of a threat is it to society? And we want to invite you to join our discussion. What do you want to know about how activism is viewed and treated by FBI and law enforcement? And do you remember how the Judy Berry bombing was covered back in the 1990s? Did you think Earth First tactics were extreme? And if you were part of or are now part of Earth First or any other counterculture direct action group, you know, from civil rights movement to Occupy, tell us what your experience has been. You can call us at 866-798-TALK. That's a toll-free number, 866-798-8255. I'm Holly Kernan, and you're listening to Your Call. We'll be right back after this short break.
You're listening to Your Call on KALW San Francisco. We have a free email newsletter. Join more than 7,000 of your fellow listeners who get an email every week or two that will keep you aware of the diverse programming on local public radio, as well as opportunities to participate in station events. Just click the email newsletter link on the front page of KALW.org.
For those of you joining us now, I'm Holly Kernan, and this is Your Call. We're podcasting our show. You can find more information at yourcallradio.org. That's also where you can listen to past shows and sign up for our newsletter to find out what's coming up next. Tomorrow, we'll have a conversation about how can we save our parks. What state park would you most want to save? And Friday is our media roundtable. That's the day that we speak with journalists about the week's news coverage. Monday, we're going to talk about student debt. An entire generation has taken on thousands of dollars in debt. So what does this mean for the future of our economy? And today we're talking about what explains the crackdown on environmental activists. We're speaking with Daryl Cherney about his film Who Bombed Judy Berry? Cherney and Berry, fellow Earth First activists, were struck by a car bomb in 1990. The Oakland police and the FBI accused Berry and Cherney of carrying the bomb for use in a terrorist act. That was later found not to be true, and the case was dropped for lack of evidence. We're also joined by Dennis Cunningham, one of the lawyers on the Judy Berry case, and Will Potter, who's the author of Green is the New Red, an insider's account of a social movement under siege. So why are environmentalists under siege, and what can we do about it? You can join our conversation by sending us an email to feedback@yourcallradio.org or give us a call at our toll-free number 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. So before the break, Dennis, you were telling us about the context of this, but we also want to hear a little bit about the case. I mean, this is a case that dragged on for years and years and years. Can you explain what was happening in this case?
Well, in the case, we tried to show, and we did show, I think, that the FBI and the Oakland police knew perfectly well that Judy and Daryl were not involved with the bomb that blew up in their car, and that the bomb was put there to try to, and targeting Judy in particular was her car. And Daryl, I think, would say he only happened to be riding in it at that moment by chance. The point was that they knew from the evidence, and I think there is more than just the evidence, that at the moment that was a ridiculous theory of what had happened. And the bomb was clearly put in the car to hurt Judy, and but it was also rigged, I think, to make it to put a plausible basis on the, or a semi-plausible basis on the accusation that it was her bomb. In other words, the people that tried to kill her did not want to make a martyr out of her. That's for sure. They wanted to brand her as a terrorist and brand Earth First as a terrorist group in a much more serious way than anything that had happened prior to that. I mean, bombing a person or taking a bomb, which they called, the FBI immediately characterized it as an anti-personnel bomb because of the nails that were strapped to the outside, which made it completely implausible for a bomb to hurt the person in the car, because you don't need the shrapnel effect to blow up a car. So the point was to be able to say that she was taking the bomb to do something with it, and that's what they did. And that reverberated across the country. There was a huge 3-4 column picture on the front page of the New York Times above the fold, calling them, you know, the victims are terrorists or whatever the headline was.
And why do you think that OPD and the FBI thought that or targeted Daryl and Judy?
Because I think the FBI wanted to blow up the so-called eco-terrorist threat as far as, I'd use the term blow up, to magnify that threat as much as they could and pump a lot of public attention towards it. I think the OPD just went along with them because they were, you know, I think they had a relationship that was deep. But the actual police officers that were involved in the case were homicide detectives, and they just did whatever the FBI told them. But the reason was to smear Earth First.
And that's Dennis Cunningham. He's an attorney for Judy Berry and Daryl Cherney. We're also speaking with Daryl Cherney, who's the producer of the film Who Bombed Judy Berry. You can find out how to see that movie at our website, yourcallradio.org. We're also speaking with Will Potter, author of Green is the New Red, an insider's account of a social movement under siege. You're listening to Your Call. I'm Holly Kernan, and we have so many callers. I'd like to bring them into the conversation. Let's start with Sigbrit in San Francisco. Hi, Sigbrit.
Hi there.
Hi, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, I'm just so glad this movie's finally being done. I was a reporter up in the West North Coast back in the early 90s and met Judy Berry, Daryl Cherney, and saw the whole thing unfold about 6 months before the bombing. I got to know the movement. I did a lot of stories about what was happening up there, and I was just shocked when the bomb, you know, when they were bombed, and because I knew them, and I knew her as a mother. She had young children at the time, and I just couldn't imagine that she would have been transporting weapons, you know, and risked her life knowing that she had that, those small children. So it really didn't make sense to me, and at that point, I smelled a rat, and I think this whole thing is unbelievable, and people really need to know what's going on in terms of the FBI, the Oakland police. It's quite a scandal.
And thank you so much for calling. You know, Sigrid, let's hear a little bit more from Daryl Cherney's film, Who Bombed Judy Berry. Let's hear Judy Berry talking about really just her pain and paralyzing fear for being under investigation.
I was terrified, and I was terrified not just because of the bombing. I was equally terrified that I would be framed for this bombing and spend my children's childhood in prison and not get to raise my children. I learned through this experience that extreme fear is a physical phenomenon and not just a mental phenomenon. I would shake uncontrollably, and people would try to hold me and calm me down and have great difficulty doing so. I experienced complete sleeplessness. I could not sleep at all. I would be awake the entire night 100% of the time. It just felt like there was a hole in my stomach. I was so scared. I couldn't focus on, you know, it consumed my consciousness, how petrified I was. I didn't know the extent of my physical injuries. I knew that I was in traction and was being told that I would probably spend my life in a wheelchair. But I was, the thought of doing that in prison was very frightening.
And that is Judy Berry, the late Judy Berry, from the film Who Bombed Judy Berry. You can see that film. It's going to be playing next week on Thursday, May 10th and Friday, May 11th. Thursday, May 10th, it's at the Real Work May Day Labor Festival at San Jose City College. Friday, May 11th, it's at the Santa Cruz Film Festival. We'll put information about all of that at our website, yourcallradio.org. So, Will, when you were listening to that, what were you thinking? And, you know, you were also targeted by the FBI, and I know that a lot of fear followed you for a long time with that. You write about it pretty extensively in your book.
And nothing I experienced came anywhere even remotely close to what Judy Berry and Daryl Cherney and, unfortunately, many other people have endured through some of these tactics. And unfortunately, you know, as I was listening to that, it reminded me of a lot of other cases I've followed closely, contemporary cases. I mean, these tactics, as was indicated earlier, haven't gone away. I mean, they've really become quite pervasive. Just a couple days ago, there were a roundup of activists in Ohio, and the government and the FBI sent out press releases announcing that a terrorist plot by anarchists affiliated with the Occupy movement was thwarted. Well, when you look into the court documents, and I have an article up now on greenisthenewred.com, it turns out that the FBI was instrumental in making this plot happen. I mean, these people were talking about destroying and vandalizing bank signs, and then they were, you know, led along this path that, and supplied with the explosives by the FBI and by an undercover informant. We're seeing tactics like this just repeatedly. So it really raises a lot of questions, as you heard in the Judy Berry clip. And it also has the effect of and creating a lot of fear among activists who are paying attention to things like this going on. And I think that's the most important thing that we need to be aware of in trying to respond against is those fear tactics.
And it was actually the FBI targeting you in a much smaller way, obviously, but that really led you on the journey to write this book.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I was a reporter at the Chicago Tribune, and I decided to go out leafleting because my day job at the Trib was leaving me feeling pretty dark and depressed, writing about murder after murder every day and, you know, police cases. And I was arrested, and, you know, the short version of the story is I was visited by the FBI and threatened to be put on a domestic terrorist list unless I became an informant. And that really started an obsession for me in finding out how all of this came about. And through the course of that, I mean, Judy Barry's and Daryl Turney's case was really a key mile marker in this very long march and long escalation of tactics against a growing movement.
And let's go to more callers. Let's go to Foy in Oakland. Welcome to your call, Foy.
Hi, thank you. I have a comment and then a question. At the time, I was repelled by the crude sexual symbolism of planting the bomb where Judy Barry's private parts were exposed first to the explosion, much like the assassin aimed at Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s mouth, throat, you know? So this obvious piece of hate immediately indicated to me that operatives of the forces of oppression had planted the bomb. Do your guests have input on the women-hating symbolism that I felt at the time?
Go ahead, Daryl.
Well, certainly, you know, somebody took credit for the bomb, and the credit, somebody calling themselves the Lord's Avenger, and the Lord's Avenger was an entirely misogynist, woman-hating treatise, a three-page letter basically saying that he targeted Judy Barry because she was a woman who was not obedient. And I could go on, but you're absolutely correct about that. So I'll just leave it at that. And Judy was a radical feminist. She was more than just an environmentalist and a mother and a labor organizer. She was a very strong feminist. So I agree with you 100%, caller.
So as we mentioned that no one has ever been arrested besides you two, they did not continue the investigation. But in 1991, local journalist Steve Talbot made a movie, which is also called Who Bombed Judy Barry? And his documentary showed clearly that the FBI and the OPD mishandled the case, ignored evidence, and it absolved you and Barry and said that the FBI neglected to pursue other evidence that pointed to other suspects. And then Talbot followed that evidence, and he points to Judy Barry's ex-husband, Mike Sweeney, as a suspect. And after her death, he revealed that it was Judy Barry who told him that Sweeney might have done it. I know that this is extremely controversial, but I just wanted to put that out there so that we're clear about all of this. Why is that so controversial, Daryl?
Well, it's really easy. First of all, he pointed to five suspects, and probably the most prominent suspect was a man named Irv Sutley, whose DNA, whose family DNA, actually shows up on a police informant letter and Judy Barry's first death threat. And it was Steve Talbot who actually uncovered that information. It is absolutely true that we looked at quite a number of suspects at the very beginning, including Judy Barry's ex-husband. We later, soon afterwards, exonerated him because he had alibis. You know, you have to be in the right location in order to put the bomb in the car, and Judy's husband was way up north, and the car was way down south in Oakland, and Mike Sweeney was up in the Ukiah area. So he didn't really have the opportunity to put the bomb in the car. However, because we were keeping a very open mind, and here, let me present something to you. If I had not gotten into the car that day by chance or by fate, which Dennis Cunningham earlier pointed out, I would have been a suspect because I was Judy Barry's ex-boyfriend, and the exes are always looked at. I would just say if anybody has evidence, no matter who it is, they should step forward and present it to law enforcement. Bottom line is, regardless of who it is, the FBI was there in just a moment. So whether it was somebody from the timber industry, or which I greatly suspect it was done on the timber industry's behalf because they had the motive, or an ex-husband, the feds used that opportunity to politically tarnish both Judy Barry and myself. And so that does not negate at all from the fact that our civil rights were violated.
And Daryl, the FBI has wanted to destroy the remaining evidence in this case. As part of your settlement, you got the opportunity to challenge that, and you've just been the court has just ordered that evidence from the bombing be released for independent forensic testing. So who's going to do this testing, and what do you think these tests could reveal?
Well, we Dennis Cunningham's handling this aspect of things, but we have chosen forensic analytical sciences in Hayward, California, who's a professional criminal forensics laboratory, independent. The evidence will not be touched by anybody except the professionals. It's not going through myself or Dennis. And there's a second bomb in our case that people don't realize, and that or often don't know about. The bomber who struck Judy Barry first bombed the Louisiana Pacific Lumber Company sawmill in Cloverdale, California, about 30 miles north of Santa Rosa. And he tried to, in the letter taking credit for the bomb, said he tried to frame Judy Barry for bombing that sawmill. Well, that bomb barely went off, and that bomb has about 6 feet of duct tape on it. You can have fingerprints, DNA, hair samples, skin flakes, not to mention the fact that basically an unexploded or a partially exploded bomb that's relatively intact is a holy grail of bomb investigations, and anybody can tell you that.
Well, let's have Dennis talk to us about what's going to happen next in this case and whether this bombing will ever be solved.
Well, that's a good question, but it's certainly true that they never attempted to analyze this evidence or any other evidence in an honest way to try and trace who the bombers were. And there is a possibility, we'll see, that as the scientists say, some biology may be recoverable from this physical evidence that the FBI has been sitting on for 20 years. That biology may in turn give rise to some DNA that's traceable, and it's possible, theoretically and practically, that somebody who participated in making the bomb, at least the first bomb, the earlier bomb, the intact bomb, could be identified. Where that would then lead is anybody's guess, because in the normal course of things, it would be the government that was had to do the investigating, and they've already declared themselves as how they feel about the case.
And that's Dennis Cunningham. He's the attorney for Judy Barry and Daryl Cherney. We're also speaking with Daryl Cherney, the producer of the film Who Bombed Judy Barry, and Will Potter, who's the author of Green is the New Red, an insider's account of a social movement under siege. I'm going to go to more callers, but let me give out the number one more time if you want to join our conversation about environmental activism and government surveillance. We're at 866-798-TALK. That's a toll-free number, 866-798-8255. Is sabotage terrorism? Is economic sabotage terrorism? Activist Tim DeChristopher is currently serving a 2-year prison sentence for entering his name in a Bureau of Land Management auction back in 2008. Is that a reasonable punishment for that crime? And what do you want to know about how activism is viewed and treated by the FBI and law enforcement? How radical is reasonable in the struggle for ecological and other types of justice? You can give us a call at 866-798-8255, toll-free number 866-798-8255. You can also send us an email to feedback@yourcallradio.org. And let me read one of these emails that we just got. We got an email from MF saying, your guest has tapped the bottom line. It is corporate interests, in other words, the profits of billion-dollar industries that are threatened by any environmental activism. When activists try to protect natural resources and habitats from destruction or disclose to the public the horrors of factory farming, the government will step in on behalf of corporations. And that's a lot of what you say in your book, Will Potter. Let's go to Major Resin in Monterey. Welcome to your call.
Hi. First of all, my heart goes out to Judy. She's one of my personal heroes, even though I never actually got to meet her. I got involved in Earth First in the middle of the 90s, around the Santa Cruz area, and a girlfriend at the time told me Judy Berry's story, and I was really amazed. I was really inspired. It got me to move up to Humboldt County, and I participated in a training camp in 1997 in the Stafford area of southern Humboldt. And there I got involved in Earth First. And at the time there, just to give the listening audience just an idea of what it's like being there, learning how to defend the forest. I mean, first of all, all the exercises we do to learn how to defend the forest is all mock exercises. And we're told right away there's potential infiltrators. There's potential FBI agents among us. You can't trust anyone. So we would pretend to do these little actions and have these little games. We would play cat and mouse, and some people would pretend to be the loggers, and some people would pretend to be the activists, and we'd do these little things to train each other, and then it was on our own have to find and meet people and gain trust of each other. So there was this already division happening just in the Earth First itself. You know, people fell into little cliques, nobody trusted each other. Mm. So this whole idea of COINTELPRO was like undermining our whole effort to do our actions. And
Very interesting. Thank you so much for sharing that. I'm just going to go through a couple of callers and then get response from our panel. Let's go to Grant in Santa Cruz. Hi.
I don't have that point yet.
Grant?
Oh, yeah, sorry.
Hi, hello. Welcome to your call.
Thank you. And I'm calling from Santa Cruz, and I just, I'm actually one of 11 people that have been charged with felony conspiracy charges regarding an Occupy-related event that happened here in November.
And was that the bank?
Yeah, it was the takeover of a vacant building, which was a former Wells Fargo bank. But it's interesting because I would consider myself a reasonable activist, and myself and between 100 and 300 people walked in and out of that empty building within the first 3 days of its occupation. Out of those 300 people, they charged 11 people with felony charges, felony conspiracy and felony vandalism. I was there for about an hour. And also they've charged, of those 11 people, about half of them are independent media people, which I think is, just, again, a very political move on the part of police. And you know, it's very eye-opening, and it's certainly the charges of conspiracy, which are very Orwellian, I think is
felony conspiracy.
Yes. And if people are interested in just finding out a little bit more about that, I mean, people are going to full jury trials as part of this. It seems to me to be very targeted, whether it's local police, the district attorney, or maybe federal authorities are involved too. But I think this is a trend that's happening around the country.
Well, Grant, we'll be sure to look into this. We're running short on time, but this might be a good subject for a full show. So thank you so much for calling in. We'll look up some information and put a link to that at yourcallradio.org. Let's get to one more caller and then get response from our panelists. Art in San Francisco, welcome to your call. You're going to have to be really quick. Can you just ask your question?
Okay, just want to get the panelists' comment on the National Defense Authorization Act, which just went into law this year, and it allows the Department of Defense to pick up anyone accused of being a terrorist.
Gotcha. Okay, let's thank you, Art. I so apologize for cutting you off. It's just because of time. So let's get a response. Let's start from the National Defense Authorization Act. Will Potter.
I think the significance of that bill is that it's codifying and cementing policies that have been informally in use by the Bush administration and continued into the Obama administration. So what we're really seeing with policies like this is this elaborate use of the war on terrorism to label a wide range of people as terrorists because of their political beliefs and political activity is really being codified into law. And I think that should give everyone's pause, not just for the environmental and animal activists that we've talked about on this program, but with the Occupy movement and anyone who's involved with that as well.
And you also write about, we didn't get to it, the Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act, which is a part of this kind of crackdown. I hope we'll be able to have you back on again, Will. Dennis Cunningham, you wanted to...
Well, you want to also realize that that the Defense Authorization Act involves the incorporation of the military into the so-called anti-terrorism police state schema that now is going to, and you can certainly see it on the front page of the paper this morning in terms of Occupy, all of these movements which threaten the status quo are recognized within the establishment as a menace and a danger, and their only response is repression.
And Daryl, let's get, you have about 15 seconds to give us your final response. And one of the callers talked about, you know, getting people within the movement not to trust anyone, not to trust each other.
Well, I think that was a bit of an exaggeration. We did have a lot of trust, but let me say, the climate is warming, the hole in the ozone is growing, the economy is collapsing, wars are being waged everywhere, so the stakes are extremely high. We are, in fact, standing our ground and defending our planet as best as we can, and I think the movie Who Bombed Judy Barry is an example of how you can win. Our movie is laden with victories of saving forests, of defeating the FBI at its own game, and so I would just say that there is hope and there is inspiration out there.
Thank you. That's a great way to end it. I'm sorry we're running out of time. We've been speaking with, you just heard from Daryl Cherney, producer of the film Who Bombed Judy Barry. We'll put links to how you can see that film at our website. It's yourcallradio.org. We were also joined by Dennis Cunningham, attorney for Judy Barry and Daryl, and Will Potter, author of Red. Green is the New Red, an insider's account of a social movement under siege. We'll put a link to web resources at our new website, yourcallradio.org. Thanks for joining us. I'm Holly Kernan, and here's what's coming up tomorrow. How can we save our state parks? On the next Your Call, we'll talk about state park closures. Due to budget cuts, California faces the indefinite closure of 70 of its 278 state parks this summer. But an alternative to the closures may be in transferring the parks to private or nonprofit ownership. How do you think we can best keep our parks open while keeping their integrity? Join us at 10 or send an email to feedback@yourcallradio.org. Are you planning to visit a state park this summer? It's Your Call with Rose Aguilar and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To listen to past shows or to sign up for our podcast or newsletter, visit yourcallradio.org. You can also friend us on Facebook. Ali Budner and Malihe Razazan produce the show. Matt Martin is executive producer. Becca Hoekstra is our intern. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer. And Alan Farley is our studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.